39. Eddie and Susanna heard heavy motors start up almost directly beneath them. A moment later, a wide strip of the marble floor began to pull slowly back, revealing a long, lighted slot below. The floor was disappearing in their direction. Eddie seized the handles of Susanna's chair and rolled it rapidly backward along the steel barrier between the monorail platform and the rest of the cradle. There were several pillars along the course of the growing rectangle of light, and Eddie waited for them to tumble into the hole as the floor upon which they stood disappeared from beneath their bases. It didn't happen. The pillars went on serenely standing, seeming to float on nothing. "I see an escalator," Susanna shouted over the endless pulsing alarm. She was leaning forward, peering into the hole. "Aha!" Eddie shouted back. "We got the L station up here, so it must be Notions, Perfume, and Ladies' Lingerie down there." "What?" "Never mind." "Eddie!" Susanna screamed. Delighted surprise burst over her face like a 4th of July firework. She leaned even further forward, pointing, and Eddie had to grab her to keep her from tumbling out of the chair.
"It's Roland! It's both of them!"
There was a shuddery thump as the slot in the floor opened to its maximum length and stopped. The motors which had driven it along its hidden tracks cut out in a long, dying whine. Eddie ran to the edge of the hole and saw Roland riding on one of the escalator steps. Jake, white-faced, bruised, bloody, but clearly Jake and clearly alive, was standing next to him and leaning on the gunslinger's shoulder. And sitting on the step right behind them, looking up with his bright eyes, was Oi.
"Roland! Jake!"
Eddie shouted. He leaped up, waving his hands over his head, and came down dancing on the edge of the slot. If he'd been wearing a hat, he would have thrown it in the air. They looked up and waved. Jake was grinning, Eddie saw, and even old Long Tall and Ugly looked as if he might break down and crack a smile before long. Wonders, Eddie thought, would never cease. His heart suddenly felt too big for his chest, and he danced faster, waving his arms and whooping, afraid that if he didn't keep moving, his joy and relief might actually cause him to burst. Until this moment, he had not realized how positive his heart had become that they would never see Roland and Jake again.
"Hey, guys! All right! Far fucking out! Get your asses up here!"
"Eddie, help me!" He turned. Susanna was trying to struggle out of her chair, but a fold of the deerskin trousers she was wearing had gotten caught in the brake mechanism. She was laughing and weeping at the same time, her dark eyes blazing with happiness. Eddie lifted her from the chair so violently that it crashed over on its side. He danced her around in a circle. She clung to his neck with one hand and waved strenuously with the other.
"Roland, Jake, get on up here! Shuck your butts, you hear me?"
When they reached the top, Eddie embraced Roland, pounding him on the back, while Susanna covered Jake's upturned, laughing face with kisses. Oi ran around in tight figure eights, barking shrilly.
"Sugar," Susanna said. "You all right?"
"Yes," Jake said. He was still grinning, but tears stood in his eyes.
"And glad to be here. You'll never know how glad."
"I can guess, Sugar. You can bet on that."
She turned to look at Roland.
"What did they do to him? His face looked like somebody run over it with a bulldozer."
"That was mostly gasher," Roland said. "He won't be bothering Jake again, or anyone else."
"What about you, big boy? You all right?"
Roland nodded, looking about. "So this is the cradle."
"Yes,"
Eddie said. He was peering into the slot.
"What's down there?"
"Machines and madness."
"Loquacious as ever, I see."
Eddie looked at Roland, smiling.
"Do you know how happy I am to see you, man? Do you have any idea?"
"Yes, I think I do." Roland smiled then, thinking of how people changed. There had been a time, and not so long ago, when Eddie had been on the edge of cutting his throat with the gunslinger's own knife. The engines below them started up again. The escalator came to a stop. The slot in the floor began to slide closed once more. Jake went to Susanna's overturned chair, and as he was riding it, he caught sight of the smooth pink shape beyond the iron bars. His breath stopped, and the dream he had had after leaving River Crossing returned full force, the vast pink bullet shape slicing across the empty lands of western Missouri toward him and Oi. Two big triangular windows glittering high up in the blank face of that oncoming monster, windows like eyes. And now his dream was becoming reality, just as he had known it eventually would.
"It's just an awful choo-choo train, and its name is Blaine the Pain."
Eddie walked over and slung an arm around Jake's shoulders.
"Well, there it is, champ, just as advertised. What do you think of it?"
"Not too much, actually."
This was an understatement of colossal size, but Jake was too drained to do any better.
"Me either," Eddie said. "It talks, and it likes riddles."
Jake nodded. Roland had Susanna planted on one hip, and together they were examining the control box with its diamond pattern of raised number pads. Jake and Eddie joined them. Eddie found he had to keep looking down at Jake in order to verify that it wasn't just his imagination or wishful thinking. The boy was really here.
"What now?"
he asked Roland. Roland slipped his finger lightly over the numbered buttons which made up the diamond shape and shook his head. He didn't know.
"Because I think the Mono's engines are cycling faster," Eddie said. "I mean, it's hard to tell for sure with that alarm blatting, but I think it is. And it's a robot, after all. What if it, like, leaves without us?"
"Blaine!" Susanna shouted. "Blaine, are you—"
"Listen closely, my friends," Blaine's voice boomed. "There are large stockpiles of chemical and biological warfare canisters under the city. I have started a sequence which will cause an explosion and release this gas. This explosion will occur in 12 minutes. The voice fell silent for a moment, and then the voice of little Blaine, almost buried by the steady, pulsing whoop of the alarm, came to them.
"I was afraid of something like this. You must hurry."
Eddie ignored little Blaine, who wasn't telling him a damn thing he didn't already know. Of course they had to hurry, but that fact was running a distant second at the moment. Something much larger occupied most of his mind.
"Why?" he asked. "Why in God's name would you do that?"
"I should think it obvious. I can't nuke the city without destroying myself as well. And how could I take you where you want to go if I were destroyed?"
"But there are still thousands of people in the city," Eddie said. "You'll kill them."
"Yes," Blaine said calmly. "See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. Don't forget to write."
"Why?" Susanna shouted. "Why, goddamn you?"
"Because they bore me. You four, however, I find rather interesting. Of course, how long I continue to find you interesting will depend on how good your riddles are. And speaking of riddles, hadn't you better get to work solving mine? You have exactly 11 minutes and 20 seconds before the canisters rupture."
"Stop it!" Jake yelled over the blatting siren. "It isn't just the city. Gas like that could float anywhere. It could even kill the old people in River Crossing."
"Tough titty," said the kitty, Blaine responded unfeelingly. "Although I believe they can count on measuring out their lives in coffee spoons for a few more years. The autumn storms have begun, and the prevailing winds will carry the gases away from them. The situation of you four is, however, very different. You better put on your thinking caps, or it's see you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. Don't forget to write." The voice paused. "One piece of additional input. This gas is not painless."
"Take it back," Jake said. "We'll still tell you riddles, won't we, Roland? We'll tell all the riddles you want. Just take it back."
Blaine began to laugh. He laughed for a long time, pealing shrieks of electronic mirth into the wide, empty space of the cradle, where it mingled with the monotonous, drilling beat of the alarm.
"Stop it!" Susanna shouted. "Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!"
Blaine did. A moment later, the alarm cut off in mid-blat. The ensuing silence, broken only by the pounding rain, was deafening. Now the voice issuing from the speaker was very soft, thoughtful, and utterly without mercy. "You now have 10 minutes, Blaine said. "Let's see just how interesting you really are." Forty. Andrew.
"There's no Andrew here, stranger," he thought. "Andrew is long gone. Andrew is no more, as I shall soon be no more."
"Andrew," the voice insisted.
It came from far away. It came from outside the cider press that had once been his head. Once there had been a boy named Andrew, and his father had taken that boy to a park on the far western side of Ludd, a park where there had been apple trees and a rusty tin shack that looked like hell and smelled like heaven. In answer to his question, Andrew's father had told him it was called the Cider House. Then he gave Andrew a pat on the head, told him not to be afraid, and led him through the blanket-covered doorway. There had been more apples, baskets and baskets of them, stacked against the walls inside, and there had also been a scrawny old man named Dewlap, whose muscles writhed beneath his white skin like worms, and whose job was to feed the apples, basket by basket, to the loose-jointed, clanking machine which stood in the middle of the room. What came out of the pipe jutting from the far end of the machine was sweet cider. Another man, he no longer remembered what this one's name might have been, stood there, his job to fill jug after jug with the cider. A third man stood behind him, and his job was to clout the jug filler on the head if there was too much spillage. Andrew's father had given him a glass of the foaming cider, and although he had tasted a great many forgotten delicacies during his years in the city, he had never tasted anything finer than that sweet, cold drink. It had been like swallowing a gust of October wind. Yet what he remembered even more clearly than the taste of the cider or the wormy shift and squiggle of Dewlap's muscles as he dumped the baskets was the merciless way the machine reduced the big red-gold apples to liquid. 2 dozen rollers had carried them beneath a revolving steel drum with holes punched in it. The apples had first been squeezed and then actually popped, spilling their juices down an inclined trough while a screen caught the seeds and pulp. Now his head was the cider press, and his brains were the apples. Soon they would pop as the apples had popped beneath the roller, and the blessed darkness would swallow him. "Andrew, raise your head and look at me." He couldn't, and wouldn't even if he could. Better to just lie here and wait for the darkness. He was supposed to be dead anyway. Hadn't the hellish squint put a bullet in his brain? "It didn't go anywhere near your brain, you horse's ass, and you're not dying. You've just got a headache. You will die, though, if you don't stop lying there and puling in your own blood. And I will make sure, Andrew, that your dying makes what you are feeling now seem like bliss." It was not the threats which caused the man on the floor to raise his head, but rather the way the owner of that penetrating, hissing voice seemed to have read his mind. His head came up slowly, and the agony was excruciating. Heavy objects seemed to go sliding and careering around the bony case which contained what was left of his mind, ripping bloody channels through his brain as they went. A long, syrupy moan escaped him. There was a flapping, tickling sensation on his right cheek, as if 12 flies were crawling in the blood there. He wanted to shoo them away, but he knew that he needed both hands just to support himself. The figure standing on the far side of the room by the hatch which led to the kitchen looked ghastly, unreal. This was partly because the overhead lights were still strobing, partly because he was seeing the newcomer with only one eye. He couldn't remember what had happened to the other and didn't want to. But he had an idea it was mostly because the creature was ghastly and unreal. It looked like a man, but the fellow who had once been Andrew Quick had an idea it really wasn't a man at all. The stranger standing in front of the hatch wore a short dark jacket belted at the waist, faded denim trousers, and old dusty boots. The boots of a countryman, a range rider, or a gunslinger, Andrew? The stranger asked and tittered. The TikTok man stared desperately at the figure in the doorway, trying to see the face, but the short jacket had a hood, and it was up. The stranger's countenance was lost in its shadows. The siren stopped in mid-whoop. The emergency lights stayed on, but they at least stopped flashing. "There," the stranger said in his, or its, whispery, penetrating voice. "At last we can hear ourselves think." "Who are you?" the TikTok man asked. He moved slightly, and more of those weights went sliding through his head, ripping fresh channels in his brain. As terrible as that feeling was, the awful tickling of the flies on his right cheek was somehow worse. "I'm a man of many handles, partner,"
the man said from inside the darkness of his hood, and although his voice was grave, Tick-Tock heard laughter lurking just below the surface. There's some that call me Jimmy, and some that call me Timmy, some that call me Handy, and some that call me Dandy. They can call me loser, or they can call me winner, just as long as they don't call me in too late for dinner. The man in the doorway threw back his head, and his laughter chilled the skin of the wounded man's arms and back into lumps of goose flesh. It was like the howl of a wolf. "I have been called the Ageless Stranger," the man said. He began to walk toward Tick-Tock, and as he did, the man on the floor moaned and tried to scrabble backward. "I have also been called Merlin, or Merlin, and who cares, because I was never that one, although I never denied it either. I am sometimes called the Magician, or the Wizard. But I hope we can go forward together on more humble terms, Andrew, more human terms." He pushed back the hood, revealing a fair, broad-browed face that was not for all its pleasant looks in any way human. Large, hectic roses rode the wizard's cheekbones. His blue-green eyes sparkled with a gusty joy far too wild to be sane. His blue-black hair stood up in zany clumps like the feathers of a raven. His lips, lushly red, parted to reveal the teeth of a cannibal. "Call me Fannin," the grinning apparition said. "Richard Fannin. That's not exactly right, maybe, but I reckon it's close enough for government work." He held out a hand whose palm was utterly devoid of lines. "What do you say, pard? Shake the hand that shook the world." The creature who had once been Andrew Quick and who had been known in the halls of the Greys as the Tick-Tock Man shrieked and again tried to wriggle backward. The flap of scalp, peeled loose by the low-caliber bullet which had only grooved his skull instead of penetrating it, swung back and forth. The long strands of gray-blonde hair continued to tickle against his cheek. Quick, however, no longer felt it. He had even forgotten the ache in his skull and the throb from the socket where his left eye had been. His entire consciousness had fused into one thought: "I must get away from this beast that looks like a man." But when the stranger seized his right hand and shook it, that thought passed like a dream on waking. The scream which had been locked in Quick's breast escaped his lips in a lover's sigh. He stared dumbly up at the grinning newcomer. The loose flap of his scalp swung and dangled. "Is that bothering you? It must be. Here." Fannin seized the hanging flap and ripped it briskly off Quick's head, revealing a bleary swatch of skull. There was a noise like heavy cloth tearing. Quick shrieked. "There, there, it only hurts for a second." The man was now squatting on his hunkers before Quick and speaking as an indulgent parent might speak to a child with a splinter in his finger. "Isn't that so?"
Yes, Quick muttered.
And it was. Already the pain was fading, and when Fannin reached toward him again, caressing the left side of his face, Quick's jerk backward was only a reflex quickly mastered. As the lineless hand stroked, he felt strength flowing back into him. He looked up at the newcomer with dumb gratitude, lips quivering. "Is that better, Andrew? It is, isn't it?"
"Yes, yes."
"If you want to thank me, as I'm sure you do, you must say something an old acquaintance of mine used to say. He ended up betraying me, but he was a good friend for quite some time anyway, and I still have a soft spot in my heart for him. Say, 'My life for you.' Andrew, can you say that?" He could, and he did. In fact, it seemed he couldn't stop saying it.
"My life for you, my life for you, my life for you, my life—"
The stranger touched his cheek again, but this time a huge raw bolt of pain blasted across Andrew Quick's head. He screamed. "Sorry about that, but time is short, and you were starting to sound like a broken record. Andrew, let me put it to you with no bark on it. How would you like to kill the squint who shot you? Not to mention his friends, and the hard case who brought him here, him most of all. Even the mutt that took your eye, Andrew, would you like that?"
"Yes," the former Tick-Tock Man gasped,
his hands clenched into bloody fists.
"Yes!"
"That's good," the stranger said, and helped Quick to his feet. Because they have to die. They're meddling with things they have no business meddling with. I expected Blaine to take care of them, but things have gone much too far to depend on anything. After all, who would have thought they could get as far as they have?
I don't know, Quick said.
He did not, in fact, have the slightest idea what the stranger was talking about. Nor did he care. There was a feeling of exaltation creeping through his mind like some excellent drug, and after the pain of the cider press, that was enough for him, more than enough.
Richard Fannin's lips curled. Bear and bone, key and rose, day and night, time and tide. Enough. Enough, I say. They must not draw closer to the tower than they are now.
Quick staggered backward as the man's hands shot out with the flickery speed of heat lightning. One broke the chain which held the tiny glass-enclosed pendulum clock, the other stripped Jake Chambers' Seiko from his forearm.
"I'll just take these, shall I?"
Fannin the wizard smiled charmingly, his lips modestly closed over those awful teeth.
"Or do you object?"
"No," Quick said, surrendering the last symbols of his long leadership without a qualm, without in fact even being aware that he was doing so.
"Be my guest." "Thank you, Andrew," the dark man said softly. "Now we must step lively. I'm expecting a drastic change in the atmosphere of these environs in the next 5 minutes or so. We must get to the nearest closet where gas masks are stored before that happens, and it's apt to be a near thing." I could survive the change quite nicely, but I'm afraid you might have some difficulties.
I don't understand what you're talking about, Andrew Quick said.
His head had begun to throb again, and his mind was whirling.
Nor do you need to, the stranger said smoothly.
Come, Andrew, I think we should hurry.
Busy, busy day, huh?
With luck, Blaine will fry them right on the platform, or they are no doubt still standing. He's become very eccentric over the years, poor fellow. But I think we should hurry just the same. He slid his arm over Quick's shoulders, and, giggling, led him through the hatchway Roland and Jake had used only a few minutes before.
Six. Riddle and Wastelands.
1. All right, Roland said. Tell me his riddle.
What about all the people out there?
Eddie asked, pointing across the wide, pillared plaza of the Cradle and toward the city beyond.
What can we do for them?
Nothing, Roland said. But it's still possible that we may be able to do something for ourselves. Now, what was the riddle?
Eddie looked toward the streamlined shape of the Mono.
He said we'd have to prime the pump to get him going, only his pump primes backward. Does it mean anything to you?
Roland thought it over carefully, then shook his head. He looked down at Jake. Any ideas, Jake?
Jake shook his head. I don't even see a pump.
That's probably the easy part, Roland said. We say he and him instead of it and that because Blaine sounds like a living being, but he's still a machine. A sophisticated one, but a machine. He started his own engines, but it must take some sort of code or combination to open the gates and the train doors.
We better hurry up, Jake said nervously. It's got to be 2 or 3 minutes since he last talked to us, at least.
Don't count on it, Eddie said gloomily. Time's weird over here.
Still...
Yeah, yeah. Eddie glanced toward Susanna, but she was sitting astride Roland's hip and looking at the numeric diamond with a daydreamy expression on her face. He looked back at Roland.
I'm pretty sure you're right about it being a combination. That must be what all those number pads are for.
He raised his voice.
Is that it, Blaine? Have we got at least that much right?
No response, only the quickening rumble of the Mono's engines.
Roland... Susanna said abruptly. You have to help me.
The daydreamy look was being replaced by an expression of mingled horror, dismay, and determination. To Roland's eye, she had never looked more beautiful or more alone. She had been on his shoulders when they stood at the edge of the clearing and watched the bear trying to claw Eddie out of the tree, and Roland had not seen her expression when he told her she must be the one to shoot it. But he knew what that expression had been, for he was seeing it now. Car was a wheel, its one purpose to turn, and in the end it always came back to the place where it had started. So it had ever been, and so it was now. Susanna was once again facing the bear, and her face said she knew it.
"What?" he asked. "What is it, Susanna?"
"I know the answer, but I can't get it. It's stuck in my mind, the way a fishbone can get stuck in your throat. I need you to help me remember. Not his face, but his voice. What he said."
Jake glanced down at his wrist and was surprised all over again by a memory of the TikTok man's cat-like green eyes when he saw not his watch, but only the place where it had been, a white shape outlined by his deeply tanned skin. How much longer did they have? Surely no more than 7 minutes, and that was being generous. He looked up and saw that Roland had removed a cartridge from his gun belt and was walking it back and forth across the knuckles of his left hand. Jake felt his eyelids immediately grow heavy and looked away fast.
"What voice would you remember, Susanna Dean?" Roland asked in a low, musing voice.
His eyes were not fixed on her face, but on the cartridge as it did its endless, limber dance across his knuckles, and back, across, and back. He didn't need to look up to know that Jake had looked away from the dance of the cartridge, and Susanna had not. He began to speed it up, until the cartridge almost seemed to be floating above the back of his hand.
"Help me remember the voice of my father," Susanna Dean said.
2. For a moment there was silence, except for a distant, crumping explosion in the city, the rain pounding on the roof of the cradle, and the fat throb of the monorail's slow trans engines. Then a low-pitched hydraulic hum cut through the air. Eddie looked away from the cartridge, dancing across the gunslinger's fingers. It took an effort. He realized that in another few moments he would have been hypnotized himself, and peered through the iron bars. A slim silver rod was pushing itself up from the sloping pink surface between Blaine's forward windows. It looked like an antenna of some kind.
"Susanna?" Roland asked in that same low voice.
"What?"
Her eyes were open, but her voice was distant and breathy, the voice of someone who is sleep-talking.
"Do you remember the voice of your father?"
"Yes, but I can't hear it."
6 minutes, my friends.
Eddie and Jake started and looked toward the control box speaker, but Susanna seemed not to have heard at all. She only stared at the floating cartridge. Below it, Roland's knuckles rippled up and down like the heddles of a loom.
"Try, Susanna," Roland urged.
And suddenly he felt Susanna change within the circle of his right arm. She seemed to gain weight, and in some indefinable way vitality as well. It was as if her essence had somehow changed. And it had.
"Why you want to bother with that bitch?"
the raspy voice of Detta Walker asked. 3. Detta sounded both exasperated and amused.
"She never got no better than a C in math her whole life. Wouldn't have got that without me to help her."
She paused, then added grudgingly,
"And Daddy, he helped some, too. I knowed about them for special numbers, but was him showed us the net. My, I got the biggest kick out of that," she chuckled. "Reason Suze can't remember is 'cause old Detta never understood about them for special numbers in the first place."
"What for special numbers?" Eddie asked.
"Prime numbers."
She pronounced the word prime in a way that almost rhymed with calm. She looked at Roland, appearing to be wholly awake again now, except she was not Susanna. Nor was she the same wretched, devilish creature who had previously gone under the name of Detta Walker, although she sounded the same.
"She went to Daddy crying and carrying on 'cause she was flunking that math course. And it wasn't nothing but funny book algebra at that. She could do the work. If I could, she could. But she didn't want to. Poetry reading bitch like her, too good for a little Ars Mathematica, you see."
Detta threw her head back and laughed, but the poisoned, half-mad bitterness was gone from the sound. She seemed genuinely amused at the foolishness of her mental twin.
"And Daddy, he say, 'I'm gonna show you a trick, Odetta. I learned it in college. It helped me get through this prime number business, and it's gonna help you, too. Help you find most any prime number you want.' Odetta, dumb as ever, she say, 'Teacher say, ain't no formula for prime numbers, Daddy.' And Daddy, he say right back, 'They ain't. But you can catch him, Odetta, if you have a net.' He called it the net of Eratosthenes. Take me over to that box on the wall, Roland. I'm going to answer that honky computer's riddle. I'm going to throw you a net and catch you a train ride.
Roland took her over, closely followed by Eddie, Jake, and Oi.
Give me that piece of charcoal you keep in your poke.
He rummaged and brought out a short stub of blackened stick. Detta took it and peered at the diamond-shaped grid of numbers.
"Ain't exactly the way Daddy showed me, but I reckon it comes to the same," she said after a moment. "Prime number be like me, ornery and for special. It gotta be a number don't never divide even, excepting by one and its own self. Two is prime 'cause you can divide it by one and two, but it's the only even number that's prime. You can take out all the rest that's even."
"I'm lost," Eddie said.
"That's 'cause you're just a stupid white boy,"
Detta said, but not unkindly. She looked closely at the diamond shape a moment longer, then quickly began to touch the tip of the charcoal to all the even-numbered pads, leaving small black smudges on them.
"Three's prime, but no product you get by multiplying three can be prime," she said.
And now Roland heard an odd but wonderful thing. Detta was fading out of the woman's voice. She was being replaced not by Odetta Holmes, but by Susanna Dean. He would not have to bring her out of this trance. She was coming out of it on her own, quite naturally. Susanna began using her charcoal to touch the multiples of three which were left, now that the even numbers had been eliminated, 9, 15, 21, and so on.
"Same with 5 and 7, she murmured.
And suddenly she was awake, and all Susanna Dean again.
"You just have to mark the odd ones, like 25, that haven't been crossed out already."
The diamond shape on the control box now looked like this. 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23, 29, 31, 37, 41, 43, 47, 53, 59, 61, 67, 71, 73, 79, 83, 89, 97. "There," she said tiredly.
"What's left in the net are all the prime numbers between 1 and 100. I'm pretty sure that's the combination that opens the gate."
"You have 1 minute, my friends. You are proving to be a good deal thicker than I had hoped you would be." Eddie ignored Blaine's voice and threw his arms around Susanna.
"Are you back, Suze? Are you awake?"
"Yes. I woke up in the middle of what she was saying, but I let her talk a little longer anyway. It seemed impolite to interrupt."
She looked at Roland.
"What do you say? Want to go for it?"
50 seconds. "Yes. You try the combination, Susanna. It's your answer." She reached out toward the top of the diamond, but Jake put his hand over hers.
"No," he said. "This pump primes backward. Remember?"
She looked startled, then smiled.
"That's right. Clever Blaine, and clever Jake, too."
They watched in silence as she pushed each number in turn, starting with 97. There was a minute click as each pad locked down. There was no tension-filled pause after she touched the last button. The gate in the center of the barrier immediately began to slide up on its tracks, rattling harshly and showering down flakes of rust from somewhere high above as it went.
"Not bad at all," Blaine said admiringly. "I'm looking forward to this very much. May I suggest you climb on board quickly? In fact, you may wish to run. There are several gas outlets in this area."
4. Three human beings, one carrying a fourth on his hip, and one small furry animal, ran through the opening in the barrier and sprinted toward Blaine the Mono. It stood, humming in its narrow loading bay, half above the platform and half below it, looking like a giant cartridge, one which had been painted an incongruous shade of pink, lying in the open breech of a high-powered rifle. In the vastness of the cradle, Roland and the others looked like mere moving specks. Above them, flocks of pigeons, now with only 40 seconds to live, swooped and swirled beneath the cradle's ancient roof. As the travelers approached the Mono, a curved section of its pink hull slid up, revealing a doorway. Beyond it was thick, pale blue carpeting.
"Welcome to Blaine," a soothing voice said as they pelted aboard.
They all recognized that voice. It was a slightly louder, slightly more confident version of Little Blaine. Praise the Imperium. Please make sure your transit card is available for collection. And remember that false boarding is a serious crime punishable by law. We hope you enjoy your trip. Welcome to Blaine. Praise the Imperium. Please make sure your transit card, the voice suddenly sped up, first becoming the chatter of a human chipmunk, and then a high-pitched, gabbly whine. There was a brief electronic curse, boop, and then it cut out entirely. I think we can dispense with that boring old shit, don't you? Blaine asked. From outside came a tremendous thudding explosion. Eddie, who was now carrying Susanna, was thrown forward and would have fallen if Roland hadn't caught him by the arm. Until that moment, Eddie had held on to the desperate notion that Blaine's threat about the poison gas was no more than a sick joke. You should have known better, he thought. Anyone who thinks impressions of old movie actors is funny absolutely cannot be trusted. I think it's like a law of nature. Behind them, the curved section of hull slid back into place with a soft thud. Air began to hiss gently from hidden vents, and Jake felt his ears pop gently. I think he just pressurized the cabin. Eddie nodded, looking around with wide eyes. I felt it, too. Look at this place. Wow! He had once read of an aviation company, Regent Air, it might have been, that had catered to people who wanted to fly between New York and Los Angeles in a grander style than airlines such as Delta and United allowed for. They had operated a customized 727, complete with drawing room, bar, video lounge, and sleeper compartments. He imagined the interior of that plane must have looked a little like what he was seeing now. They were standing in a long, tubular room furnished with plush-upholstered swivel chairs and modular sofas. At the far end of the compartment, which had to be at least 80 feet long, was an area that looked not like a bar but a cozy bistro. An instrument that could have been a harpsichord stood on a pedestal of polished wood, highlighted by a hidden baby spotlight. Eddie almost expected Hoagy Carmichael to appear and start tinkling out stardust. Indirect lighting glowed from panels placed high along the walls, and dependent from the ceiling halfway down the compartment was a chandelier. To Jake it looked like a smaller replica of the one which had lain in ruins on the ballroom floor of the mansion. Nor did this surprise him. He had begun to take such connections and doublings as a matter of course. The only thing about this splendid room which seemed wrong was its lack of even a single window. The pièce de résistance stood on a pedestal below the chandelier. It was an ice sculpture of a gunslinger with a revolver in his left hand. The right hand was holding the bridle of the ice horse that walked head down and tired behind him. Eddie could see there were only 3 digits on this hand, the last 2 fingers and the thumb. Jake, Eddie, and Susanna stared in fascination at the haggard face beneath the frozen hat as the floor began to thrum gently beneath their feet. The resemblance to Roland was remarkable. "I had to work rather fast, I'm afraid," Blaine said modestly. "Does it do anything for you?"
"It's absolutely amazing," Susanna said.
"Thank you, Susanna of New York." Eddie was testing one of the sofas with his hand. It was incredibly soft. Touching it made him want to sleep for at least 16 hours.
"The great old ones really traveled in style, didn't they?"
Blaine laughed again, and the shrill, not quite sane undertone of that laugh made them look at each other uneasily. "Don't get the wrong idea," Blaine said. "This was the Barony cabin, what I believe you would call first class."
"Where are the other cars?"
Blaine ignored the question. Beneath their feet, the throb of the engines continued to speed up. Susanna was reminded of how the pilots revved their engines before charging down the runway at LaGuardia or Idlewild. "Please take your seats, my interesting new friends." Jake dropped into one of the swivel chairs. Oi jumped promptly into his lap. Roland took the chair nearest him, sparing one glance at the ice sculpture. The barrel of the revolver was beginning to drip slowly into the shallow china basin in which the sculpture stood. Eddie sat down on one of the sofas with Susanna. It was every bit as comfortable as his hand had told him it would be.
"Exactly where are we going, Blaine?"
Blaine replied in the patient voice of someone who realizes he is speaking to a mental inferior and must make allowances. "Along the path of the beam, at least as far along it as my track goes." "To the Dark Tower?" Roland asked. Susanna realized it was the first time the gunslinger had actually spoken to the loquacious ghost in the machine below Ludd.
Only as far as Topeka,
Jake said in a low voice.
Yes, Blaine said. Topeka is the name of my terminating point, although I am surprised you know it.
With all you know about our world, Jake thought, how come you don't know that some lady wrote a book about you, Blaine? Was it the name change? Was something that simple enough to fool a complicated machine like you into overlooking your own biography? And what about Beryl Evans, the woman who supposedly wrote Charlie the Choo-Choo? Did you know her, Blaine? And where is she now?
Good questions, but Jake somehow didn't think this would be a good time to ask them. The throb of the engines became steadily stronger. A faint thud, not nearly as strong as the explosion which had shaken the cradle as they boarded, ran through the floor. An expression of alarm crossed Susanna's face.
Oh, shit! Eddie, my wheelchair! It's back there!
Eddie put an arm around her shoulders.
Too late now, babe, he said, as Blaine the Mono began to move, sliding toward its slot in the cradle for the first time in 10 years, and for the last time in its long, long history.
Five. The Barony cabin has a particularly fine visual mode, Blaine said. Would you like me to activate it? Jake glanced at Roland, who shrugged and nodded.
Yes, please, Jake said.
What happened then was so spectacular that it stunned all of them to silence, although Roland, who knew little of technology, but who had spent his entire life on comfortable terms with magic, was the least wonderstruck of the four. It was not a matter of windows appearing in the compartment's curved walls. The entire cabin, floor and ceiling, as well as walls, grew milky, grew translucent, grew transparent, and then disappeared completely. Within a space of 5 seconds, Blaine the Mono seemed to be gone, and the pilgrim seemed to be zooming through the lanes of the city with no aid or support at all. Susanna and Eddie clutched each other like small children in the path of a charging animal. Oi barked and tried to jump down the front of Jake's shirt. Jake barely noticed. He was clutching the sides of his seat and looking from side to side, his eyes wide with amazement. His initial alarm was being replaced by amazed delight. The furniture groupings were still here, he saw. So was the bar, the piano harpsichord, and the ice sculpture Blaine had created as a party favor. But now this living room configuration appeared to be cruising 70 feet above Ludd's rain-soaked central district. 5 feet to Jake's left, Eddie and Susanna were floating along on one of the couches. 3 feet to his right, Roland was sitting in a powder-blue swivel chair, his dusty, battered boots resting on nothing, flying serenely over the rubble-strewn urban wasteland below. Jake could feel the carpet beneath his moccasins, but his eyes insisted that neither the carpet nor the floor beneath it was still there. He looked back over his shoulder and saw the dark slot in the stone flank of the cradle slowly receding in the distance.
Eddie, Susanna, check it out!
Jake got to his feet, holding Oi inside his shirt, and began to walk slowly through what looked like empty space. Taking the initial step required a great deal of willpower, because his eyes told him there was nothing at all between the floating islands of furniture, but once he began to move, the undeniable feel of the floor beneath him made it easier. To Eddie and Susanna, the boy appeared to be walking on thin air, while the battered, dingy buildings of the city slid by on either side.
"Don't do that, kid," Eddie said feebly. "You're going to make me sick up."
Jake lifted Oi carefully out of his shirt.
"It's okay," he said, and set him down. "See?"
"Oi!"
the bumbler agreed. But after one look between his paws at the city park currently unrolling beneath them, he attempted to crawl onto Jake's feet and sit on his moccasins. Jake looked forward and saw the broad gray stroke of the monorail track ahead of them, rising slowly but steadily through the buildings and disappearing into the rain. He looked down again and saw nothing but the street and floating membranes of low cloud.
"How come I can't see the track underneath us, Blaine?"
"The images you see are computer-generated," Blaine replied. "The computer erases the track from the lower quadrant image in order to present a more pleasing view, and also to reinforce the illusion that the passengers are flying."
"It's incredible," Susanna murmured.
Her initial fear had passed, and she was looking around eagerly.
"It's like being on a flying carpet. I keep expecting the wind to blow back my hair."
"I can provide that sensation if you like," Blaine said. Also a little moisture, which will match current outside conditions. It might necessitate a change of clothes, however.
That's all right, Blaine. There's such a thing as taking an illusion too far.
The track slipped through a tall cluster of buildings, which reminded Jake a little of the Wall Street area in New York. When they cleared these, the track dipped to pass under what looked like an elevated road. That was when they saw the purple cloud and the crowd of people fleeing before it.